And our guests, Christopher Knight, Alan Butler, later this hour, Richard C. Hoagland, our science advisor, will join us as we talk about who built the moon right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Christopher Knight, Alan Butler, our guest. I'm George Norrie. Gentlemen, when you looked at the relative size of the moon compared it to the Earth, what was the first thing that popped up while you were doing this?
Well, the first thing that we noticed was the fact that this ancient unit of measurement we'd been looking at worked perfectly on the moon, which was sort of crazy, which is... So we started looking at the moon in general. And the Earth rotates 366 times as it goes around the sun once. So you could sort of say the Earth's number is 366. And the moon rotates around one orbit around the Earth in 27.322 days. Now, the strange thing is that the moon is 27.322% of the Earth, and the Earth is 366% of the Moon. So their own orbits are exactly the same as their relative sizes. Now, that struck us as crazy. And we already knew that, as Isaac Asimov said, that the eclipse is the most extraordinary coincidence in the universe, that the Moon is 400 times smaller than the Sun and 400 times the distance. So we started to look at the numbers involved, and all of them just work perfectly. In 366 lunar orbits, the Earth has exactly 10,000 days. The moon turns through 400 kilometers exactly in one day. It's exactly 1% of the speed of rotation of the Earth. All of the numbers just are perfect, and the same numbers keep popping up. It was very, very strange.
The evolution and the life on this planet, you believe, was basically safeguarded because of this moon. Explain how.
The basic building block of life is DNA, and it's an extremely complex substance, is DNA. In fact, the author Lyle Watson once said that he computed that there are... more unlikelihood of DNA coming together in open space than the number of known atoms in the universe. Ergo, it couldn't really have happened, and yet we know that it did because we're here. Now, we make a suggestion in the book that it seems most likely that DNA was actually seeded on the Earth when the conditions were right for it to be put there, which would, to some extent, explain how DNA could be here. But I think the most important thing is to realize that first of all, the Earth had to be right in order to be able to sustain life. Just one example of that from scientific research is that there was massive tides upon the Earth in the early days because the moon was much closer to the Earth. And the constant coming and going of huge tides has been suggested as one of the mechanisms by which DNA was allowed to function and to grow in the way that it did. The moon allowed Earth life to develop also because of its physical properties and the effect it had on the Earth. For example, the fact that it kept a seasonal quality to the Earth. If it were not for the fact that the Earth maintained the orbit it does around the Sun, we would have very hot equators and very cold polar regions and nothing in between. We need a temperate world in order for life to be sustained, and that's in fact what has happened. There are many ways in which we can show that the moon has, if you like, cherished and incubated life upon the Earth.
I mean, the essential ingredient is water, and there is nowhere in the known universe where water is at a liquid state, because in the temperature ranges that exist, from absolute zero to absolute huge temperatures, so there's no upper limit, water is only liquid in this tiny, tiny sliver of temperature range, which happens on Earth. Most of Earth has got fluid water, which is what we need to produce intelligent life. Clearly, we're made of water, and without it, you just could not have higher life. So the moon has kept the Earth at the correct angle to maintain this liquid that is life-giving. Without it, we would just be another frozen planet flying around the sun pointlessly.
Well, they had some knowledge then that this moon was critical to the planet. I wonder if whoever did it or whatever did it did this in other systems. What do you think?
They haven't done it in this solar system, but yes, maybe, possibly, some super force has gone around different galaxies and different solar systems doing similar things. We don't know. But we're now starting to see and understand other Earth-type situations in other areas of space, and we haven't seen anything like it elsewhere yet. But that's very early on.
It was mentioned also worth saying at this point in time that if some agency had done it elsewhere, each situation, each case would be different than the other, because what needs to be done first is to analyse the size and distance of the planet in question and the sun, and then to make a moon which not only does all the prerequisites in terms of sustaining life, but which would give intelligent creatures upon that planet a good indication of what's happened.
Let's paint a scenario, if you would. The Earth has formed or is forming. There is no moon. Kind of tell us what's going on here in this solar system.
Well, what you've got is a situation like Venus, where the Earth was and the other planets were coalescing from debris, that soup that was sort of spinning around the sun. All the planets were in the same plane. And Venus, for instance, collapsed in around itself and has almost like a shiny marble surface. So you've just got this great sort of ball bearing, this sort of like steel object. The moon was like, in its first phase, was like a plow. A farmer who wants to grow something and you've got a baked surface has to go out and break the surface, pulling their plow with their oxen or tractor in these days. And then you've got a chance of growing something. That's what the moon was in its first stage. It was a plow to carve up the surface of the Earth. Without it, we would be dead, like the planet Venus.
Okay, and then explain, because we might as well get into it, what you think happened. I mean, why did whatever, spot this planet and make this decision?
That really very much depends upon which candidate you go for. At the end of this whole investigation and writing process, Chris and I have no doubt whatsoever that somebody or something made the moon. The only difficulty is establishing who that was, because the circumstances under which it was done would be different in each case.
You talked about three possibilities earlier. We might as well just outline them.
Okay. The first possibility that we came up with is, to many people, the most obvious, and it is one that some people who've read our book and have got in touch with us quite clearly cling to, and that is that it was done by God. At first sight, this seems extremely likely, and it's something that Chris and I discussed a great deal. Who would be in a better position to want to help humanity to develop than God? And if God was working within the known laws of physics, which he himself had created, then he would have to bring about some mechanism by which life could be incubated on the Earth. But this poses quite practical as well as ethical problems. For a start, the kind of God that we accept across most religions in the world is a God who exists by faith, not necessarily by proof. Of course, it would mean a great change in religion if we not only thought that God existed, but could see examples of his handwriting, as in the case of the moon. But we have another potential problem here. We know that the Earth and the Sun existed before the moon was created, because the moon has been created from the material and from the patterns of the Sun and the Earth. That being the case, the moon is definitely an afterthought. And we had to ask ourselves, is it likely that an omnipotent and omnipresent being such as God would need to tweak his own creation, as it were? That's the first possibility, God.
Okay. All right, next one.
Well, the next one was alien beings, advanced creatures from some other part of the universe that were so way ahead that they could travel these huge distances and had taken it upon themselves to spot likely planets for seeding life. and they, on their travels, saw the Earth and thought, yep, we can do a bit of work here, and they created the moon and went away again. But they left their calling card to say they'd done it. The problem with that is that the message that is designed is clearly designed to come to us today and clearly designed to come to human beings, ten-fingered creatures, because everything's in base 10. So they would have had to have known how we were going to develop. But there again, it's possible they were also responsible for the seeding of the DNA. So it's not an impossible theory. But it's interesting that, you know, scientists are increasingly talking about this sort of possibility as being real. I mean, Professor Anthony Flew, who's a lifetime atheist and doesn't believe in anything like that, in his 80s, had turned around last year and said a superintelligence is the only good explanation for origin of life on Earth. And so he believes that God has done it, but it could equally well be some well-meaning aliens. If somebody wants to believe it's God, fine. If somebody wants to believe it's aliens, fine. But we have a third theory, which we think is slightly more likely.
And this one, and then I want you to put them all on the table, and then we'll go back to the God one first, alien being second, and then this third one again. And I want to be able to review a little bit each one. But the third theory then, tell us how you came up with it, first and foremost.
Well, it seemed to us that the creatures who would have the best interest in creating the moon were the very same creatures who'd noticed what the moon was doing, and that is us. And although it sounds at first quite strange and difficult to get your head around, as we know from reactions we have from our readers, our third theory is that the people who created the moon was us. Nobody in the solar system, nobody in the universe has a better investment in life having developed on Earth than the very intelligent creatures who have come to rule the Earth, and that's humanity. So, again, you know, having to explain it very briefly makes it sound extremely odd. But what we're suggesting is this, that at some stage in the future, humanity takes on board what we are saying here, realizes that the moon is artificial, and also realizes that it will be our job to do it. Now, this involves time travel. There isn't a scientist in the world who can tell you that time travel doesn't exist, but I suppose your scientists will then go on to tell us that you can't prove a negative. But there are many quite influential physicists who positively do accept the possibility of time travel. And what would be necessary, of course, would be for people or perhaps machines to go back in time and to the dawn of the solar system and to create the very moon that we see over our heads at the moment.
Now, this is an interesting theory because it's almost like a paradox. If they came back in time to build the moon, how did they get here in the first place?
The problem with the paradox is that, by definition, it can't be solved. It just means it's something that humans can't get their head around. But all scientists are agreed that the laws of physics and the laws of mathematics indicate that time travel is possible, and an increasing number of people say it is going to happen. And, in fact, it may be happening within the next 12 months. There are experiments being created to send subatomic particles backwards in time. And there are people working on it to send larger objects backwards in time. There is absolutely no reason why it shouldn't exist. But yet people say, well, if we built the moon so we'd be here, you've got a sort of circle. Yes, you have, but there's no problem with it. It may hurt your head to think about it, but scientifically, it's squeaky clean. So the only of the three alternatives, the only one that is scientifically squeaky, completely squeaky clean, is the time travel theory.
It is a strange theory, though. It really is.
It sounds strange, but it isn't.
Let's just have a look at this paradox just for a very brief moment.
Sure.
One of the main reasons why people suggest that time travel would be impossible is the famous paradox of a person who goes back in time and shoots their own grandfather. Now, having done so, of course, your mother or your father would not be born, and if they were not born, then you would not exist in order to go back to shoot your grandfather. But you can turn that paradox completely on its head, and you can say, what happens if your grandfather is walking down the road and he's about to be run down by a passing bus, and it is your absolute necessity and duty to go back in time and push him away from the bus? In other words, if you don't actually go back in time and do that, then your grandfather won't exist and therefore you won't exist. So although the paradox sounds insoluble, it can be turned completely on its head. And if you extend that to our idea with regard to the moon, it could be suggested that the moon is there, the moon was made, somebody made it, we made it, therefore we have to go back in time to make it. And the only paradox develops if we don't.
What about dimensional travelers? Is that possible?
The whole idea about time travel creates all sorts of possible explanations, and one of these being that, yes, you can go back in time, yes, you could shoot your own grandfather, but what would happen immediately is that you would pass into a different dimension then. And there are physicists who believe that there are almost countless dimensions taking place at the same time. So everything on each dimensional Earth is just very slightly different, and one of those is the one where you have gone back and shot your grandfather. So in other words, what they're suggesting is you cannot create a paradox in your present dimension, but when you create the paradox, you pass into a different dimension. That's a possibility, and nobody can say that it isn't so, but we can't really understand, when we really look at all the evidence available, why it's impossible to affect your own environment in your own dimension.
Is our moon that different from other moons in the solar system?
Absolutely it is. Fundamentally different. In terms of its size relative to its host planet, its makeup, its structure from high density core outwards, its orbital characteristics. When we found this very clear mathematical patterning, we immediately looked at every other body in the solar system to see if this was something that happened elsewhere. It doesn't happen anywhere. It's just chaos, random numbers, which draws all the more attention to the Earth-Moon-Sun relationship. There is something fundamentally imperfect about it. We aren't number-picking. We're not picking the numbers that suit us. Everything about the Moon is absolutely mathematically perfect within the metric system, and in terms of proportions and percentages. And every other body in the solar system is completely random.
We took our books when they first came out, and we sent them to a whole series of leading scientists and begged and pleaded with these people to get back to us and tell us where we had gone wrong. In other words, where were our numbers wrong? And the reaction has been absolutely nothing. And we feel sure that if somebody could take our book to pieces and say, look, you've invented this, or look, you've massaged this, or you've made this, that somebody would have done so by now. And the fact is that our numbers are sound, and if the numbers are sound, then the strangeness of the moon is sound, and we need some explanation.
The mathematics involved in your theory is very important, isn't it?
Everything that we have done is based upon those mathematics, and in particular, our observation that there is a relationship between the size ratio of the Earth, the moon, and the sun, and the orbital characteristics of the moon around the Earth. We suggest that by the laws of chance, these should not exist. They're not only unusual, they're incredible.
Well, when we come back at the halfway point, I'm going to talk about with you your theory of God, the alien beings, and of course the one you accept, the time travelers. And we'll dive into that a little bit more a little bit later on. Science advisor Richard C. Hoagland this hour will join us as well. He's got a few questions, Richard and his technical questions, so get ready for that. I'm George Norrie, and next hour we'll open up the phone lines, give you an opportunity to talk with Christopher Knight and Alan Butler right here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, if you've been following that Japanese asteroid mission, here's an update. The Japanese space probe thought to have landed on an asteroid last month may not have collected a surface sample after all, calling into question the success of the unprecedented mission to bring the extraterrestrial material back to Earth. Data from the Hayabusa probe, now hovering several miles from the asteroid, did not indicate that the vessel had fired a metal projectile into the asteroid's surface during its landing as previously thought. So they may not know, they say, until Hayabusa comes back to Earth in sometime 2007. We'll be back in a moment with our special guest, Christopher Knight, Alan Butler, Who Built the Moon, on Coast to Coast AM. Well, there's no question, Christopher Knight and Alan Butler, that the moon is certainly a very strange object in the corner of our system here. Why have you ruled out, though, the God, the divine intervention in terms of its possible creation?
We haven't ruled anything out. In the book, we say there are three possibilities. We've named our favorite of the three.
I see.
But there's no way you can rule out the other two.
Are you waiting for someone to convince you of the other two?
Yes, we're welcoming a debate about this, and we've suggested at the end of the book that there has to be a major initiative to take stock of this, because it is a very clear, deliberate message directed at us at this point in time, and just to ignore it, it would be, well, criminal and crazy. I mean, there's a lot of people out there discussing, for instance, intelligent design, debating against the theory of evolution. Now, for us, the theory of evolution is as watertight as any theory gets. But the suggestion of intelligent design is also has a lot of merit to it. Scientists don't like the way that the debate is conducted, but it has its merits. So we would have thought that those people would be very interested in reviewing this information and joining in the debate as to whether this is a deliberate message from God, entity that created the universe, and particularly created mankind as a privileged group. So we'd welcome debate and input from those people and from the church in general. We'd also welcome input from people that are working with SETI, for instance, that are looking for extraterrestrial life. The latest thinking for physicists is that we shouldn't be looking for incoming messages from aliens. We should be looking in our own backyard, as they put it. We should be expecting to see messages deliberately left a long time ago in our own backyard. They say that. Now, they should be looking at this to see is this evidence of aliens. And then people who, leading physicists who are saying they believe time travel is going to happen and happen soon, should be looking at this. If we are right about that third possibility, mm-hmm. there is a human need for us to get our act together, get our best brains working on it, and go back and build the moon. But, yes, we want to hear debate.
Tell me how you discovered the mathematical ratios of the relationship of the Earth, Sun, and Moon, and why they're so significant.
We, first of all, came upon this because we were studying ancient measuring systems, and particularly this one called the Megalithic Yard. The Megalithic Yard was discovered, rediscovered by a man called Alexander Thom, who was a professor of engineering at Oxford University, and he spent his life, his spare time anyway, and all his retirement time, measuring the ancient monuments left by the Megalithic peoples, places such as Stonehenge and Avebury, all the way from northern Scotland right down into France. And he came up with all sorts of conclusions, and one of them that he came to was that they'd used a uniform system of measurement, which was called the Megalithic Yard. This is about 82.966 centimetres in length, and it varied by only a tiny, tiny proportion across the whole of the monuments that he measured. Now, science has looked at this and said, well, how can this be so, that such a crude civilization could make such a uniform measurement? That aside, the statistical proof that comes from Alexander Thom's work shows that this indeed did happen. Now, we looked at the Megalithic Yard, and we discovered, and show in our book Civilization One, that it was part of an integrated measuring system which encapsulated space and time and distance. And we started to look at the way that the Megalithic Yard fitted into the surface of the Earth. In a megalithic system, there are not 360 degrees in a circle, but rather 366. And they can be split, as our circle is, into minutes of arc and seconds of arc. And if you take one megalithic second of arc of the Earth, it measures 366 megalithic yards. Now, just for the sake of the exercise, we carried out the same experiment on the Moon and on the Sun, and we discovered on the Moon that same geometrical division results in exactly 100 megalithic yards, and on the Sun, it comes out at exactly 40,000 megalithic yards. And we're talking about 99.99%. fact here. So it's unlikely to be a coincidence. And once having looked at that, it drew our attention to the fact that the moon was really rather peculiar. And when we started to study the ratio, size ratio between the Earth, the moon and the sun, and then look at the orbital characteristics of the moon as they stand at the moment, that's when all these very, very strange and very similar numbers began to fall out of the system.
What I find to be fascinating, too, is all three of your potential theories, of which you believe the third one, the time traveler theory, but they all consist around some kind of intelligence. And that I find to be extremely acceptable.
There is no doubt about that. That is the one thing we will not move on. The fundamental, there's two options. It's either the biggest coincidence that has ever been heard of or could ever be conceived, or there is a message here from an intelligence, and you really would have to be extremely perverse to argue that this is some sort of bizarre coincidence, because there is one after another, after another, after another, after another, and they're all perfect. They're not marginal. There is no doubt there is a great intelligence behind this, and hence the name of the book, Who Built the Moon? The question is, who? The fact is, something did, and it's more than the moon. It's our whole species. It's our human condition that was created.
Coast to Coast science advisor and head of the EnterpriseMission.com, of course, Richard C. Hoagland, who makes his career looking at celestial objects. Richard, say hello to Christopher Knight and Alan Butler.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Richard.
Morning, Richard.
Chris and I haven't talked in a few years, but
I'm
an admirer of his work with Robert. And welcome, Alan, to a very interesting half of a very intriguing writing team.
Thank you.
You have hit another one out of the solar system, Chris.
Good.
This is provocative. It's controversial,
yep.
And I've got to hand it to you. You have courage. I could have some quibbles, and I was, sending a couple emails to George to ask questions, and I guess he threw up his hands because they were too technical, so he wants me to come on and basically ask you myself.
I need 6 degrees to figure out what you were shooting me,
well,
Richard.
Well, not really. The thing I find so intriguing is that you and I have never talked about this, Chris.
No, we haven't.
Yet we've arrived at kind of the same place. As you may know, many years ago, 40-some years ago, I was Cronkite science advisor to CBS during the Apollo missions, and so I've been following the results and the astronaut briefings and the NASA documents and the manuals and the moon rock results and the analysis. And when I got into what I'm doing now, which is running the Enterprise mission and looking at the solar system through different eyes, the idea that somebody might have been here before us and done interesting things, what really surprised the hell out of me is these same fingerprints you've been describing all evening showing up in the moon data.
Yeah.
And you're absolutely right. The numbers for the moon are absolutely bizarre. They are so bizarre that it's like the pink elephant in the room of mainstream science that nobody wants to talk about. Harold Urey, who is a very, well-known guy, he was Carl Sagan's progenitor. He actually made Carl who Carl became. He was the guy who tried to get NASA to actually go to the moon initially to do science and figure out how the hell could the damn thing be there, because you're right. A lot of people have said over the years, if it wasn't for the fact that it's there, it shouldn't be there. There was a very famous guy in celestial mechanics, and I think he was in Britain. I don't remember his name off the top of my head, but he was a celestial mechanics expert who basically figures the motions of celestial bodies using Newton's laws and Kepler's laws and all that. And he was the first to discover that the motions, George, of the moon around the Earth are so irregular on a fine measurement system that they really can't be predicted very well. They just it looked to him, and this is going to sound interesting, he ultimately came to the conclusion before the space age that the only way to explain the motions of the moon around the Earth was if it was hollow.
Well, Richard, let me ask you, of the three theories they threw out, of course, they believe the third one, God, alien beings, or time travelers. Do you agree with any one of those three as a possibility?
Well, funny you should ask. When we did the conference in Wisconsin, the God, Man, ET conference, which is a nice segue into our DVD set, which is available for Christmas at an 800 number that George Richard. Will gladly mention in a couple of minutes.
Richard.
we actually tackled this, and I brought up the very interesting thing that these gentlemen tonight have brought up, and that is that the moon appears to be evidence of intelligent design, but not God. And I agree, Chris and Alan, for the reasons you cite, that God wouldn't have to tinker with his creation after the fact. And the only difference that I really have with you is on the time scale of the tinkering. Earlier in the evening, you made rather firm assertions that you think the moon was made, built, created, simultaneous, essentially, with the Earth 4.5 billion years ago. And then when George gently asked you on what basis you felt that, you said it was the age of the moon rocks compared to the age of the oldest Earth rocks. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. Now, we date, science dates these by what's called radio chronometric measurements.
Yeah.
Radioactive isotopes that decay, and you basically are measuring when the rock cooled and became a rock as opposed to a liquid lava, right?
Yeah.
So you're propounding your theory on the idea that the radiometric ages of the moon rocks, meaning when they cooled and became solid, are as old as most of the oldest Earth rocks, right?
Yeah, we're taking that from science because we're not qualified to argue on that. So if you were to tell us that that dating is questionable...
Oh, no. The dating is fairly good, but I think I found the interesting little potential flaw in your dating, which is not the flaw in your theory.
The dating doesn't matter.
How and when it was done.
Right.
It depends on was it done.
Yeah, absolutely.
Suppose we have a technology that isn't your mini black holes, which would liquefy the surface materials of the Earth, and so you would get lava, and then it would crystallize, which is how you get moon rocks that are as old as the Earth if it was done back then, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
If you have another technology, like anti-gravity, where you can make mass or inertia go away, so you can lift the material without melting it, and then reassemble it wherever you want, quarter million miles away, where the moon is, then you'd have material that's as old as the Earth, but you wouldn't be able to use the NASA dating to tell you when it was put in place as the moon.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Is there not some evidence, Richard, that there has been volcanism on the moon?
Say again?
Is there no evidence that there has been some volcanism on the moon, that there's been volcanic activity?
They haven't measured it. They thought they were going to measure it when they landed Apollo 17 up at Mare Serenitatis, and it turns out they were looking at breccias, impacts, even you know, just meteors bombarding the moon even there.
It seems to me instinctively that there's no doubt that if you cannot prove that the moon has had volcanism, then your theory is very sound, and then the moon could be almost any age.
Well, here's how old I think it is, and you can take this for what it's worth. When I started looking at this problem, which was like decades ago, very quietly, George. I haven't talked about this to anybody except a couple of my colleagues. And it's going to be in the sequel to Monument someday if I ever get around to finishing it. My thinking was, gentlemen, let's look at the most remarkable upheaval in the history of life on Earth. And we discussed this, George, a few weeks ago when we did the intelligent design show, which is the so-called Cambrian explosion. About 600 million years ago, you go from little, simple, tiny guys, blue-green algae, dumb, stupid algae, to the most incredible explosion of all of the life we all know of on the Earth. All the species, all the families, all the genera, all the incredible complexity. In fact, there's less complexity now because of extinctions than there was back 600 million years ago when all these forms suddenly, out of nowhere, appeared.
After billions of years of nothing,
Nothing except the blue-green algae.
Yeah.
So, gentlemen, that's when I pegged the, quote, creation or the movement into the solar system of the moon. Because without the moon, in the physics model that I've been working on for 20 years, you don't have the physics to bring forth life. Your other points you made tonight about the need for the moon to create plate tectonics and all that, absolutely right on. That's why Venus is a dead twin and the Earth is a live twin. And the stability and keeping the polar axis aligned and all that stuff, yes. But the dating is the key part, and I would submit for your consideration, if you have a technology, a God-like technology, but not from God, and I'm going to pick number two. I would vote for your super alien beings as opposed to humans going back in time. And these are all testable. At some point, if we get enough data from an honest set of space agencies, not just ours, we can test these theories.
And I pick one, Richard.
Say again?
I pick number one.
I think it was a
godly creation.
Okay, well, then you have to explain, why did God hiccup and wait? And why did he wait 3.5 billion years, or 4 billion years, to roughly 500 million years ago to rechange the garden?
Because he could.
But why?
That I don't know.
Well, that's a key question. That's part of the model. You've got to answer the question. Back to my point. We're running out of time here, I guess.
Yeah, 2 minutes.
I commend you for your work. I think you have to extend it. I think you have made an incredibly good beginning, but there's all kinds of juicy nuggets to be found in the details. And as astonishing as people seem to think it is, when you started the show by saying that all the mainstream theories are even wilder and weirder, you're absolutely right.
Richard C., again, you add a different perspective. And what's fascinating is here's basically three different people. Those two is one, you and me, and we all agree on one separate issue of their three theories. That's weird.
That's great. That's the debate we want. We've started a process here, or one element of it. Richard's right. There are a lot of people coming from different directions.
Well, there was Don Wilson who wrote the book called Our Spaceship Moon, which actually started my thinking in this direction.
Sure.
By the way, Richard, since you brought it up, can you get the Godman and ET videos out for people for Christmas if they're giving them away as gifts?
Absolutely, at 1-877-345-6222.
Or on the EnterpriseMission.com website.
Absolutely.
Correct? All right, good. Thanks, Richard. Thank you,
gentlemen.
Appreciate
that. Thank you, Richard.
Always appreciate it. Yeah, you would not believe the technical things he was shooting my way. He had mathematics and ratios. I think he had a slide rule and a compass next to himself and everything else. But when we come back, gentlemen, at the top of the hour, we're going to open up the phone lines because we're going to let Coast to Coast listeners chat with you about these possibilities. And, of course, you heard it. Richard C. believes that alien intervention created the moon. Christopher Knight and Alan Butler believe that it was done by earthly time travelers. And I believe it was God, quite frankly, that the moon has a purpose, no doubt about it. And those are our different thoughts. What about yours? We'll be back with you in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.